Thanks, Mark. Can you guys hear me okay?
All right.
Yeah, it's true. If I fall asleep halfway through my talk, because I'm going on 2 hours of sleep between diaper changes and feedings. This is our first child, so a lot to get used to. But thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. We're talking about common sports medicine elbow injuries. I have no disclosures. If we talked about all of the elbow injuries in sports medicine, we'll be here for a long time. So I kind of narrowed it down. I really want to talk about the throwing athlete. Specifically, I want to look at UCL injuries, Tommy John surgery in particular. I'm looking at flexor tendonitis and some of the things that go along with UCL injuries, especially looking at valgus extension overload injuries. Then we'll take it to the younger population, looking at Little League elbow, looking at some prevention and pinch count, looking at mechanics and some recommendations as far as pinch count. And then we're looking at some distal biceps injuries as well as radial head and OCD lesions of the capitellum. So ulnar collateral ligament injuries. So when I was doing this talk, I really wanted to see how prevalent it really is. And it surprised me. If you look at professional baseball, which includes majors and minors, 10% of all players have a UCLR reconstruction. 16% of all pitchers, which makes sense, and 3% of non-pitchers. Well, when you tease the numbers out and looking at majors versus minors, 25 versus 15% for pitchers, 25% of all pitchers, 1 in 4 of every pitcher, according to this study, had a UCLR reconstruction. If you look at major league pitchers, 86% of them had the UCLR reconstructions while they're in their majors, while 61% of the minors had it during high school. And if you think about that, kind of makes sense. If you had this type of injury when you were in high school, maybe that prevented you from actually getting further along in major league because you had it in early time period. Whereas if you made it all the way to the majors and time has been invested in you and you made it to that point and then you had your UCL reconstruction, maybe you have a better chance of staying in the majors because you already made it to that level. So before we kind of get into more of UCLR, I wanted to talk about the anatomy of it. And the anatomy of it is really critical to understanding how we do the reconstruction. And I want you to first take a step back and looking at the bony anatomy. That is the most important restriction of valgus stress to the elbow. At full extension, it's about 20 degrees, and then past 120 degrees to full flexion. But when we look at that mid-range, the most important range when the pitching really occurs, it's the UCL that makes the most resistance to valgus stress, about 55% at 90 degrees of flexion, right, when they're at the pitching moment. So when we look at what is composed of the anatomy, it gets kind of confusing because there's three bundles, the anterior bundle, the posterior bundle, the transverse bundle. And then the anterior bundle is subdivided into anterior, central, and posterior band that all have different functions at different levels of flexion. But the anterior bundle is the most critical one, and that's the one we look to reconstruct, and that provides the most resistance to valgus stress at 90 degrees. So now we have a little understanding of the anatomy. Now we get to understand some of the functional pathophysiology which occurs. This is a diagram, which you've all seen before, of the pitching windup and pitching motion that goes from windup to early cocking to late cocking, acceleration, and follow through. Now I've circled the most important part, the acceleration and late cocking, because that's when the most amount of force goes across that elbow on that UCLA. So when you come out here, that's when you put in the most amount of torque, and this is where the injury occurs. And you can see it right here. This is where the stress really occurs along that that elbow joint right over there. So the risk of the injury can be associated with the velocity of the pitch, but we'll get into exactly what that means towards the end of this talk. So ulnar collateral ligament injuries, about 2/3 of them actually present with acute pop. So you will see the pitcher have the injury, they'll be in an acute pain, and they'll say, I felt it go. The other third is actually the interesting type, which is they have the chronic medial elbow pain. This is the one you really have to look for within your athletes, is something going on here. Why are they having a decrease in velocity? Why is their elbow dropping? Have they lost internal rotation in the form of glenohumeral internal restriction deficit, internal rotation deficit? Are they having some numbness in their fingers? And that's usually due to, can that be due to an underlying UCL injury because the ulnar nerve is being involved and irritated by the inflammation from the UCL injury? So while the acute may be very obvious, the chronic is a little more subtle, and that's when you really have to tease out the history and really watch your athlete. The history. So whenever you get a throwing athlete that complains of these kind of pains, you must get the pitch count, how much are they resting, the type of pitches they're doing, their stamina, the phase of which the pitch pain is elicited. This is critical because it'll tell you, give you a little more clinical diagnosis. You know, if it's curling early acceleration phase, late cocking phase versus in a deceleration phase, it can be completely different. Also, you want to look for any knee, shoulder, back, or compensatory problems that can occur secondary to this injury. So here's a video of an acute UCL injury from Weaver, professional baseball player, that occurred a few years back. So you can kind of watch it, what occurs. He almost gets his head taken off by the ball, by the way. But you can see here, he's immediately holding that elbow right there. He's complaining of pain. The athletic training staff comes out, and he knows he's felt something go and something give away. And I'll show you a replay of it. But this is when you really got to go out to the athlete and you know, calm them down and really get a good assessment of what occurred. Because because it occurs fast, and if you miss it, you don't know, did they hurt their back? Did they hurt their shoulder? But they'll give you the clue. They'll grab their elbow and they'll actually hold it at about 70 degrees of function. And they also might even say some numbness in the fingers. So we'll see it here again, right here. You can see it here, how he just grabs it immediately right there and in this immediate pain. He's lucky to get his head taken off again, but you can see his elbow down there. It goes and it just kind of is very flailing and unable to be used at that point. So we'll move on here. So physical exam is always very important in this. It always starts with inspection. You'll see swelling, edema. Again, the athlete will hold their arm at about 70 degrees. And that's the reason why they do that is just provides the least amount of inflammation and stress on that UCL at that point. And if a fusion develops, then the elbow joint isn't compromised, isn't as tight on that capsule. You'll assess range of motion. You'll look for mechanical symptoms, any catching or locking. You'll palpate the elbow at 50 to 70 degrees. Mainly, you'll feel tender subpalpation about 2 centimeters distal to the medial epicondyle. Here are two tests that we talk about, the moving valgus stress. So basically, you take the arm, 90 degrees of flexion, and you take it through a slight valgus stress, and you'll feel a painful arc from that range of motion. The second test is a milking maneuver. You grab the thumb by the side, arms are about 70 degrees, and you apply a valgus fresh test, and you'll feel medial joint opening and tender palpation. Both these tests are very sensitive for the UCL. Also, just taking the elbow through a valgus range of motion, that can be a little difficult to assess the opening, but if you do see any opening, it's consistent with a significant injury. So the next step is looking at x-rays. Then you got to get some imaging, send them to the office, get some imaging. We can do stress radiographs and see any opening of the medial joint space. A CT scan, look for any bony abnormalities, any fractures, and the most sensitive test really is an MR arthrogram, where we inject dye into the and get an MRI, and we really can see the filling defect within the UCL. So how do we treat these? You know, and it's non-operative in our lower demand, non-throwing athletes. A lot of times these can be treated and allow these to heal, and it won't affect them. You know, if they're not really stressing out their elbow, they're not going to really bother them very much, and they can be treated with typical conservative measures, anti-inflammatories, cryotherapy, physical therapy. Specifically, if you want to look at another non-operative measure, we look at PRP, platelet-rich plasma, injected into the UCL. There's one study that I reviewed, looked at Major League Baseball players who had partial tears. This was done by Andrews in Birmingham. They looked at injecting a PRP and actually had a fairly impressive return to play, about 88%. So this is an option for a partial UCL injury, for get the athlete back to play within the same season even. Operative overhead athlete, failed non-operative measure. The treatment is ulnar collateral ligament reconstruction. And we'll talk about that now, kind of going into the details of the surgical aspect of it, because I think it's very important that you guys understand what goes into the surgery, so you can counsel your patients before and after, counsel your athletes before and after they go through this. So this was first done in 1974 by Dr. Job, out at Curlin Job, in California. It was the first done on Tommy John, hence the name of the surgery. He basically reconstructed the anterior bundle through a figure of eight loop, through the graft, through the ulna on the sublime tubercle where it inserts, and it goes back to a figure of eight position through the graft. Usually use gracilis or any type of tendon like that, semitendinosus, or something a palmaris can also work in here. This first iteration at this type of surgery was very invasive. They made a big incision and took down the entire flexor pronator mass, and then did a submuscular transposition of the ulna. So one of the main complications, they had ulnar neuritis, pain in their hand, numbness and tingling, and also whether the flexor pronator mass healed when they reattached it. So it did have good success, but still there were still some complications, which led to a further refinement. One other technique that came from this is called the docking technique. The docking technique is basically you pass the graft through the ulna, through the bone tunnels, but instead of actually bone tunnels on the beat up a condyle, you kind of dock or lay down the graft on top right over there and pass stitches through drill holes right here and obviate the need for such a big takedown of the flexor pronator mass and the ulnar nerve, maybe get away with not even doing submuscular, maybe a subcuticular transposition. Finally, then the next technique, which is kind of the hybrid technique, which is very, very common in today's days, age, the reason why it's called the hybrid technique is they were looking, putting interference screws both on the medial upper condyle and the humerus, but we had some trouble with isometry. So we went back to the tunnels to the tibia, but then fixed it with the interference screw and then tacked down the UCL over here. And this can be done fairly minimally invasively, less complications, less ulnar nerve symptoms, and is also referred to as a Dane technique, named after some of its creators. So let's talk about rehab. Again, these are general guidelines. I think we're moving towards functional criteria when we're doing understanding rehab and moving back. But we also do have to understand some of the biology, and the biology does need to heal and allow the time to heal. So the first 1 week, put them in a splint and begin some gradual range of motion. Phase 2, month out to 2.5 months out, isotonic strength training, work on full range of motion from shoulder, begin some gentle exercises. Phase 3, advanced strengthening plyometric program. And phase 4, at 17 weeks, a little after 4 months, you can begin an interval throwing program. Now, does this not mean that they can get back to play? No, absolutely not. This is just a throwing program, getting back to a gradual return to getting back to play. Remember, this is a multifactorial injury that has to go with a lot with being very confident, using your body mechanics. And so it's individualized, and it can take up to 6 months to up to a year to really get back to playing. So what's the evidence on how these actually do? This was a study done looking at Major League Baseball players. What was the follow-up? And a 3-year follow-up, 87% actually had a return to play after UCLR. However, they did have an overall increase in ERA, decreased innings pitched, and an increased walks, hits, and per inning pitch. I think that's probably the most important statistics, the WHIP, because it really tells you how efficient they are. They may not be giving runs, but if they're giving up a lot of hits and a lot of walks, and you know that they're increasing their pinch count, and they may not be doing as well as they were pre-operatively before the injury. This is another study from Major League Baseball, looked at pitch velocity and pitch type. So what pitch type really indicates or leads to having UCL injuries? And they looked at all the pitchers and they looked at what was the most corresponding injury or corresponding pitch that led to a UCL injury, and actually it was the percentage of fastballs. So it's not necessarily the fastest pitcher, it was the pitcher that relied on the fastball the most that ended up having a UCL injury. So if you have a pitcher and they're a fastball pitcher and they're more than 50% of their pitches are coming from their fastball, they're at risk of having a UCL injury. Moving from UCL injuries, I want to talk a little about valgus extension overload, which is kind of like the long-term sequelae for pitchers. It's a chronic overuse injury. It's due to radial capitellar compression, and it's that same side of valgus moment. That constant valgus moment on this radial capitellar joint leads to shearing of the ulna, damage to the cartilage, posterior ossifies, and eventually continued MCL insufficiency. So this is your long-term pitcher who's been pitching for many years. They're all going to develop this type of this elbow because just the overload that occurs with the elbow joint. So rather than the acute UCL injury, this is kind of a long-term sequelae. You will see repetitive radial capitellar compression, posterior olecranon osteophytes, and MCL insufficiency. So what are the symptoms? They have pain with deceleration. Remember, that's different from the acute UCL injury, which is early acceleration, late cocking. So now we're looking at the deceleration phase. More posterior elbow pain as opposed to medial pain. Catching and locking and loss of terminal extension. So initially this is treated with NSAIDs, activity modifications, rest, but eventually they may need a resection of the osteophytes and debridement. Debridement alone and osteophytes only work is still if the UCL is intact. If the UCL is not intact, then you're just going to put them back in the same position. Then you might as well have to reconstruct the UCL at the same time. So now moving on to the other spectrum, looking at our younger athletes, looking at little league elbow. Now this occurs because the growth plate isn't fused. Okay, so this is kind of a different injury than the UCL itself. Now we're looking at the growth plate and the torsional stress that occurs across this growth plate from the physis, from the humerus to the medial upper condyle where the UCL attaches. Also a overuse syndrome associated with medial elbow pain. Associated with increased pitch count and lack of rest, some would say associated with breaking ball or off-speed type pitches, as due to a repetitive valgus stress. So here's an X-ray,
And, you know, clinically it's done by the tenous palpation and examination, but when you really want to see on an x-ray, this is the pathognomonic sign you'll see. You'll see increased joint space or increased lucency between the physis. So this should be a nice linear line like you see when it's healed, but you can see that this is growing. This is a bigger space. There's a bigger space between the two. So what you'll do is you'll come to the office, you'll get contralateral x-rays, you'll compare them to the physis, and this physis will be wider and you can make a diagnosis of little league elbow. So again, it starts, treatment is rest, activity modifications, PT. You really want to talk to the coach, the parent, educate them on limiting the number of innings pitched, and giving them rest. If there is a large avulsion of the medial epicondyle displacement, then that can be treated with open reduction and shoulder fixation. And in older patients, if they do have a UCL disruption as well, that can be treated with a UCL reconstruction. So this is kind of where we're going as far as pitch count and limiting this. And you know, these are similar to the UIL numbers, and not exactly the same. This is coming from Little League Baseball across the USA. Once again, the idea is that as the age gets older, they can pitch more, but as age is younger, you have to limit the number of pitch count. And the number of pitches thrown gives them, they need more time. As more and more pitches are thrown, they need more and more rest between the two. What you want to know, some numbers to throw out, no more than 110 pitches for high school athletes, junior high athletes no more than 85 pitches between, and pitching, they need at least 3 months off. They can pitch 9 months a year, but no more than 9 months, 3 months, then you'd have to take a break. And once again, the UIL numbers are pretty similar to this. You know, above 65, 85, they get 4 days of rest. But this is the kind of the mentality you want to get to your coaches and your parents, that pitch count matters, rest matters, and if it's not taken into account, they will have these symptoms. So I thought this was pretty interesting as far as when can they start throwing off-speed type of pitches. So fastball 8 years, changeup 10 years, curveballs 14, knuckleballs 15. And the reason why this is higher or lower, because they looked at what kind of torsion and what kind of shear stresses around the physis with these type of pitches, and when is the physis going to close. Based off of that, they kind of made some of these recommendations. And it's got to be individualized. But if you wanted some numbers on that, then you can take those numbers. I apologize if all these slides didn't make it to the talk. Next thing I want to talk about is lateral-sided elbow pain and what you should be thinking about some lateral pain. Specifically, I wanted to talk about OCD lesions of the capitellum, or osteochondral desiccans lesions of the capitellum. The capitellum, it articulates with the radial head right over here. And what it is a localized injury resulting in separation of the cartilage. So there's just like you get in the knee, you can get an OCD lesion in the capitellum, and it's consistent with lateral elbow pain. Usually occurs with patients above 10. So basically the cartilage, along with bone, may have been sheared off or may be separating from an underlying bone, and this will cause pain, mechanical symptoms. Good thing about these, a lot of these can heal, especially if they're skeletally immature, open physis, and they're willing to take the rest. Symptoms, loss of extension, catching, locking, lateral tenous palpation, and mild joint effusion. So based on the types, you can make a determination whether this is going to need surgery. If the cartilage is intact, the open growth plates, there's no fluid behind the defect on MRI, this can maybe heal with non-operative. But if they have a cartilage fracture or there's been any displacement or loosening, they may need surgical treatment. So once again, the activity, if it can be treated non-operatively, it's activity modification, 6 weeks of rest followed by gradual return to play. One study showed an average of about 3 months to really get back to full level of play. If it is loose, it may need to be debrided, it may need an osteochondral autograft taken from the knee or somewhere else to be put in there. If it's stable and can be put back together, if it's unstable but can be reattached with a small screw or a durable device, it can. We do drilling for lesions that we think that may become unstable, and we drill, try to increase vascular channels to try to get to heal. Another thing you want to look at for lateral-sided elbow pain, radial head fractures. So this is the kid that kind of falls on the outstretched hand with their arm like that, and they'll complain of elbow pain, and you should be thinking also about radial head fractures. They're classified basically on four types, and you know what you want to look at is if amount of displacement. If they're non-displaced and they have no mechanical block, and what mechanical block means is that they can't supinate their hand fully because the radial head is functioning supination. So if they're stuck, that could be an issue. That could be a displaced radial head fracture, and that would be needed to be treated. When it's displaced more than 2 millimeters, we treat these, or there's a mechanical block. If it's comminuted, we try the best to put it back together, but it may need a radial head resection or radial head replacement. And the worst type is the type 4 when it's associated with the elbow dislocation. So you can see the radial head fracture right there. it slipped off. It's almost 2 millimeters of displacement and would require a screw to be reattached to restore the articular surface. So once these are classified into three types, the main three types were Mason 1, which is a non-displaced one, treated non-operatively in a sling for about 3 weeks and then gradual range of motion. After that, the Mason 2 and 3 are usually treated with ORIF, and once again, if they're comminuted, radial head excision or radial head replacement, which hope that we never have to do that in one of our younger athletes. These two, we'll try our best to kind of just repair and get them back together. And then rehab is the same for any type of fracture, 6 weeks, letting it rehab and get gradual return to play as they can get back to throwing program. One of the final things I want to talk about is distal biceps rupture, which is more seen in our more weekend warriors or more of our older population, but can be seen in our younger population. This occurs when the elbow is eccentrically loaded, but when you try to flex your elbow at the same time. So think about what's happening. You're flexing your bicep, yet it's being pulled this way, so it causes eccentric torsion on that biceps tendon, and then it pops. Once again, your athlete will feel a pop. It'll feel immediate swelling, and they'll have a Popeye deformity. So the biceps will retract up, and they'll be able to like have a big Popeye deformity, and they'll say it looks cool, but it's actually not. It's a pretty significant and serious injury. And the main thing you lose when you don't have your distal biceps, people get this all the time wrong, it's not the flexion. It's actually because you have your brachialis muscle still intact, so your flexion is still pretty good. It's the supination. So if you're trying to screwdriver or turn a doorknob, you're not going to be able to do that as well if you don't have a distal biceps tendon. How do you diagnose this? Well, the history is critical. Just history and just looking at the patient, seeing the Popeye deformity and listening to what they tell you. But the hook test is known as the most diagnostic test. So the way you do that is you basically take your finger and hook the distal biceps tendon right underneath there. And you should get a nice little hook underneath there. If it's torn, you're not going to feel the hook, and that's pathognomonic for a distal biceps rupture. Finally, the Thompson test is also very, very important. Very similar to the Achilles tendon. When you squeeze the biceps, you see a flexion. If you don't have that, then it's also significant for a distal biceps injury. So how do we repair this? This is coming to the end of the talk. How do we repair this? Basically, you reattach it. And you should reattach it, and anybody who plans to be active, who wants that supination strength, only for the non-op, for the low demand partial injuries that are asymptomatic. But the main thing is, if someone asks you, what happens if I don't repair it? You're going to lose supination strength. 50% of sustained supination, 40% of supination strength altogether, 30% of flexion strength, and 15% of grip strength. So when you repair it, it's pretty straightforward. You just reattach it down to bone. But it's critical that you get it within 2 weeks. If you don't get this within 2 weeks, then it can retract, and then you may have to use a graft in between to span the defect because it won't come down. What are the main risk of the surgery? Injury to the nerve, the lateral anterior cutaneous nerve, or the posterior interosseous nerve. The posterior interosseous nerve is the nerve that helps you lift up your wrist like that. So it's a pretty significant injury, and you should be very careful when you do this surgery. But it does have a high success rate. Return to play is anywhere from 3 to 4 months if everything looks good and heals well. Maybe 5 months in a little more of a contact athlete. With that, I will stop, and thank you for your time and attention.